This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello and welcome to Mint Dialogues, a weekly podcast where we focus on the big questions in personal finance and investing. My name is Neil Borate and I head the personal finance team at Mint. I will be your host for this podcast. The podcast is a Mint production and is available on hdsmartcast.com, India's fastest growing podcast producing platform.
Hello folks, you are all familiar with SBI, but did you know that at one point of time it was called the Imperial Bank of India? And not just that, but this year marks the 100 years since the Imperial Bank was founded. To explain this, the very interesting history of Imperial Bank, we have Sifra Lenton, who is the Bombay History Fellow at Gateway House. Sifra, shall we begin with how this bank was founded and what existed before?
Neil, it's quite interesting. The Imperial Bank, as you rightly mentioned, was founded in 1921. And if you take the year 1921, you realize it was soon after the First World War. What existed before it were three presidency banks that were the sole or the main banks in the three presidencies of Bombay, Bengal, and Madras. What the government decided to do because of devastation of the wars, and there were a lot of bank failures during the war, and there was also the threat of London Clearing Banks coming and establishing branches here, the government decided to establish one big bank by merging the three presidency banks of Bombay, Bengal, and Madras. That's how the Imperial Bank of India came into being on the 9th of January, 1921.
Right. Now, today's Indians are familiar with the RBI as the Reserve Bank of India and Central Bank of India, which issues currency, which acts as a bank out of the government and so on. And they're familiar with SBI as a government bank which does commercial business, which accepts deposits and which gives out loans. But rather uniquely, the Imperial Bank was a little bit of both. So could you tell us about why this was and how exactly this bank worked?
Neil, you know, actually you have to set it in two contexts. One is the global context, one is the local context. What was happening globally at that point in time was that central banks were also performing commercial functions, like, you know, having holding accounts, giving loans, accepting deposits, as well as undertaking central banking functions. Central banking functions were basically acting as banker to government, banker to banks, as well as, basically managing payment, government payments. What happened was that at the time the Imperial Bank of India was founded in 1921, it was a norm then to have a central bank and a commercial bank rolled into one. So when the Imperial Bank was founded, everyone knew it was going to be a preeminent bank because it was founded with the amalgamation of three big banks, that is the three presidency banks, which were quasi-government owned. So the Imperial Bank itself took on these functions of a central bank as well as becoming a commercial bank. But with what difference? The government stepped back from the functioning of the Imperial Bank. So it was largely a joint stock bank with very, very little government interference, unlike the presidency banks, which did have some kind of government intervention at that point.
And of course, when you say joint stock, you mean that it had private ownership. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the share of Imperial Bank in the overall banking market in India at that time?
Neil, from the data that's available from the RBI, it appears that the Imperial Bank in 1926, that means 5 years after it was founded, had a sort of a market share in terms of deposits with it. That's the basis on which market share was determined, of around 33 to 34%. The exchange banks had around 18%. A large chunk was with the joint stock banks. So it was quite strong as one bank because, of course, exchange banks, there were around quite a few of them. There were around 18 or 20 of them. And joint stocks, you had around 50, 60 of them at that point in time. So you can understand, imagine the clout of the bank. Now, if you go 1934, that is before the RBI was founded, a share of the Imperial Bank in deposits actually goes down to around 21%. That of the joint banks go up to around 50, 51, 52%. And the exchange banks actually come down at that point in time. So you can see that the role is actually diminishing in some sense.
Right. The sun has set over the Imperial Bank, if not the British Empire by this time. In 1935, the RBI was founded and it slowly took over the central banking functions of the Imperial Bank. It, however, remained a preeminent commercial bank with a large government stake. And then, of course, comes the Second World War and independence. Post-independence, what happened?
What happened was that post-independence, two or three things happened. Partition took place. So that was a huge upheaval. Because when the Constituent Assembly started work, they were thinking about making a constitution for one undivided country. And then suddenly, you know, partition was announced. I mean, they were expecting it, but it wasn't really sort of, you know, it was announced on the 3rd of June, 1947. And it happened, of course, as soon as independence took place. Now, what happened was that in 1949, RBI was nationalized. Now, the RBI also, like the Imperial Bank, was a private joint stock company. So once it was nationalized, there was a cry or a demand that even the Imperial Bank of India should be nationalized to fulfill national goals. Because at that time, it was a big bank, but it was based solely on the profit motive. A lot of the people in banking, like even our future finance minister, I mean, he was there when the Imperial Bank was nationalized. That is Governor Deshmukh. He was the first Indian head of the RBI. He also wasn't really for the nationalization of the Imperial Bank of India. But then what happened, what really triggered it off, and people actually started thinking, the government started thinking of how to really nationalize this big bank with branches overseas, because it had branches in Burma, it had branches in Ceylon, it had branches in Pakistan. So how do you nationalize a bank like this? What really triggered this off was actually the All India Agricultural Survey Committee report. It was the survey committee was actually set to determine whether banking was actually reaching into rural areas. And they found that the Imperial Bank did not have those many branches to service, at least not service the rural areas in the way they would have liked it to. They didn't want to take open branches in areas which were unprofitable. That was the trigger that immediately the survey report came out. They announced the nationalization of the Imperial Bank of India.
And as we discussed before, Sifra, although they nationalized it, the private shareholders did get compensation at market rates. So their shares were not sort of forcibly taken away. So that's an interesting element of it. And in fact, most people will not know that this happened way back in 1955. Is that the correct date? Instead of the more famous Indira Gandhi nationalization of the 1970s that people are very familiar with. So there we are. The history of India's preeminent government bank, once a big part of the imperial Raj, and then moving over to the people of India. So thank you very much, Sifra. It was lovely speaking to you.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in. We will be back next week with a fresh episode. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to me at neil.b@livemint.com. To give us feedback, you can reach out to us also on HT Smartcast. We are present on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Clubhouse. To listen to more podcasts, log on to htsmartcast.com or suno naye nazariye se.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
Save big money on protecting your garden now at Menards. Messina's Animal Stopper is a liquid repellent that prevents pesky animals from damaging your garden. Available in a convenient, ready-to-use bottle. It lasts for up to 30 days, regardless of weather and watering. Save big money on Messina's Animal Stopper at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money.